This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. Tonight, my guests include Catherine Strisik, author of Thousand Cricket Song, a collection of poems that reflect Cambodian life 25 years after the invasion of the Khmer Rouge regime, and Molly Fisk, who will be reading from her latest collection, The More Difficult Beauty. Before I introduce the first of these two poets, I want to let you know of a couple of dates coming up that you might be interested in. I hope so. First of all, on Thursday, September 23rd, I will be reading from my new collection of poems, Updraft, published by Finishing Line Press, along with Molly Fisk reading from her book, The More Difficult Beauty, on Thursday, September 23rd at 7 p.m. at Books, Inc., 2251 Chestnut Street in San Francisco. If you want any more information about that reading, you can contact me at khastings@wordtemple.com. Secondly, on Saturday, October 23rd, the Word Temple Poetry Series will be having a party to celebrate the end of 5 years of this series. You are very invited to come attend at the Sebastopol Center for the Arts at 7 p.m., Saturday, October 23rd. Joining us for the party that night will be the wonderful award-winning Chicano poet and educator Francisco X. Alarcón, along with Judy Gron, performing with musician and songwriter Ann Carroll, and Jack and Adele Foley, among others. I'll be sending out more information about this event later. But meanwhile, mark your calendar, Saturday, October 23rd, 7 p.m. at the Sebastopol Center for the Arts. Okay, let's move on now to our featured poets, Catherine Strisik and Molly Fisk. Welcome, Catherine. It's nice to have you here.
Thank you, Catherine.
So you are visiting California from Taos, New Mexico, mm-hmm. where you live.
Yes.
Welcome. Congratulations. I think this is your first book of poetry.
It is my first book published, yes.
Wonderful. Well, the poems in Thousand Cricket Song come out of your own experiences in Cambodia. And there's an interesting story about how you got to go to Cambodia in the first place. What brought this trip on?
Well, my husband had been was working for the American Red Cross, International Red Cross in 1980, and was sent to the border, the Thai-Cambodian border, where he worked in a refugee camp for 3 months. And during that time, we weren't together then, but during that time, he befriended many people. One of them in particular was a young man then, Ok Domre, who had wandered in without his glasses, without speaking, who was hiding his identity like so many others who were educated. And my husband, Larry, taught him to be a barefoot doctor, and they worked together for 3 months. Larry was sent back to New Mexico, came home, and the refugee camp was bombed, and he never knew what happened to Ok Domre. And then 7 years ago, a woman from Taos who he knows went over to Phnom Penh and just as a fluke said, and totally outrageous, really, when you think that how many people, what the population is of Phnom Penh, he said, could you ask around, see if anyone has ever heard of Ok Domre? And the woman went over, spent time with her friends, left his name. And weeks later, when she arrived home, she received a phone call from her friend saying, I found Ok Domre, and he's one of the vice presidents of the Cambodian Red Cross.
Isn't that amazing?
Amazing story.
Wonderful, yeah. Wonderful story. Yeah. Dedicate the book to, among others, a few survivors. And mm-hmm. so, of course, I'm assuming these are survivors of
yes.
the Khmer Rouge.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think a lot of people think about Cambodia and its history anymore. I mean, we've had 9/11 and Iraq and Afghanistan. And, you know, it's kind of unsettling in a way to think that this history might be forgotten. The genocide that did happen under the regime
right.
of Pol Pot.
I mean, right.
2 million people being...
Right, close to 2 million. What's happening now is tribunals are going on with an international committee. One of the main, the person who was in charge of the Tolsling prison, who was a former math teacher in Cambodia, has been waiting trial since 1999. his verdict. He finally went on trial, and it was a 77-day trial that ended recently, and the verdict will be announced July 26th.
And this is from, you know, the atrocities that happened in the 1970s.
Absolutely.
So yeah. Here someone is coming to trial now.
Well, very slow because of...
It's really something. I noticed when I was doing a bunch of, you know, research on Cambodia in preparation for this. And one of the things I was surprised to find were videos on YouTube. It seems that the Khmer Rouge was as entranced of taking photos of the people they were executing as the Nazis were. So we have this history that people, if you want to see pictures of children and women and men that were executed under this horrible regime, and if you want to see videos of the prisons, you can go on YouTube and find them.
And it's there. They documented as carefully as the Nazis did. And when you go, the Tol Sling prison is now a museum. And so when you go there, the close to 14,000 people who were murdered there, their images are hanging on one of the walls. And it's very disturbing. You see the prison cells still. And
You went there with your husband and your 10-year-old daughter.
Right.
And the 10-year-old daughter, at that time, she was 10, she wasn't too much younger than some of the soldiers of that regime. And you have a poem. The poems in this book, Thousand Cricket Song, really range from very gruesome to there is some humor in it also. It's a wonderful book in that way.
Your
emotions get to go all over the place.
Right. Yeah.
But I wonder if you would go ahead and read one of the more gruesome poems we're going to start out with. It's 15-year-old Khmer Rouge soldier.
15-year-old Khmer Rouge soldier shoves the bayonet blade into the pleading mother's vagina. The blade stops short at the pubic bone for a moment, a difficult position. Yanks out the blade for a moment, stands back, watches the throb and bleed, slices through the pregnant abdomen, pulls out the fetus with a bare hand, hangs it from the line pulled taut between two trees in a forest with the others, already blackened from the day's sun.
So you traveled there with your husband and 10-year-old daughter, and what year was that?
That was 6 years ago.
What, I have to ask, what was it like for your daughter to see all of this at 10? Does she have strong memories of it?
Very strong memories, and she traveled with her notebook and pencils, but unlike me, who couldn't write a word while I was there, she was writing and keeping a journal of her travels and what she was seeing and observing. And I actually referred back to her notes at times when I was writing this book.
Excellent. Yeah.
she was fascinated with the country and thought about going possibly back at some other time of her life. I know because of Oak Domre, she was invited to come and intern there when she was older, you know.
Wonderful.
And yeah, so who knows? Oh, but yeah, she was fascinated and highly disturbed and more brave than I was, actually, because we all went to the Tol Sling prison, and then my husband and daughter, Demetra, went to the killing fields, and I had enough once I was at Tol Sling prison. She was very brave, brave with, and still will talk about the children's shoes that were there and children's skulls that she saw. So this, you know, being a child and seeing items of children's and skulls of children,
it makes it very real for
her.
One thing I learned from reading this book is that the psychiatric drug Prozac is being given widely to survivors of the Khmer Rouge. You have a poem that addresses this. It's in the second part of your book, which has an epigraph, "A dog that has nowhere to go, waves that cannot go beyond the bank," a Cambodian proverb. That's really, really nice. And the poem I'm referring to is "The New Holy Medicine."
Right. And actually, the drug isn't being used. I mean, it's there to treat the population of survivors, but it's that's the drug that's available. So it's being used to treat a combination of talk therapy that's currently used to treat a nation of 12 million traumatized people. So far, what's happened is it's the more educated people who are reaching out for help at this point and know of the few psychiatrists who have come into the country or who are trained enough to prescribe this drug. And the difference it's making in people who haven't slept in 20 years or who have cried for the last 25 years is so exciting for them. And they when I read this article, this came out of an article I read in the New York Times, was that suddenly their stomach aches went away and they were laughing. Wow. And they hadn't laughed
for the first time in decades.
Yes, and decades, yeah. Yeah.
Why don't you go ahead and read the poem?
The New Holy Medicine. They had tried monks' blessings, Chinese cures, and faith healers. They had tried herbal remedies and home altars for praying. They had blackouts, convulsions. They had nightmares. They had all the karma they could take.
Thank you. Maybe a good poem to follow up with is The Breaking. It's the poem right before this one in the book. Mm-hmm. It not only gives us a little tour of one of the busier intersections in Cambodia, but it depicts a woman who may be under the influence of Prozac herself. I don't know. It's at once a nice and disturbing scene.
Right. And I think my image of this woman, like so many of the women in Cambodia, was... not because I didn't realize the whole Prozac part of this while I was there. That was something I learned while I was writing this book. But I felt like she was more protective of herself and was still looking out very cautiously at the world. Mm-hmm. And The Breaking. Ride all afternoon in a tuk-tuk off Sisawath Quay, off Monavong Boulevard, behind the country truck that's just entered the city from National Route 1. Notice the eyes peering out from the slats along the sides of the truck. Witness the nuances of innocence and the strain in the lines of a woman. See not only the wicker baskets with live pigs grunting inside and the bicycles and luggage piled high. Reflect her lack of expression between the chickens and the ducks clucking and quacking. She prays to Buddha and almost sleeps on her feet while the slats' shadows lengthen against her cheeks. Imagine only quiet, and beyond that, her gaze back at you while the tightly woven baskets with fruits and vegetables for Phnom Penh's markets are unloaded. Become undone by her smile, by the unbearable humidity in the sky's hazy white. Watch her yawn and her sarong shift below her waist. She moves to the ground and you smell garlic cloves, ginseng, and the heat flows from her because the breaking can no longer be bodied again.
I realize that not all of the poems in this book are from your direct experience. They're from creating experiences that have happened in the past.
Right.
Maybe is Bodyguard a good example of one of those poems?
Bodyguard came from actually a personal experience with my own body.
Oh my God.
So I'm not sure.
Okay. So this is not a good example of that.
But it actually encompasses more than that, because we're talking, the poem also is talking about, as women, how we need to continue to protect ourselves. And Bodyguard, when I wrote the poem and used Bodyguard, initially I was thinking of the bodyguards of Domrey who were with us on much of the journey. And then when I wrote the poem, I separated the words bodyguard because it became evident that we were guarding our bodies while there from what occurs to women all over the world at this point. And still, and Cambodia has a tremendous problem with prostitution and children, young girls being taken, sold by their families into prostitution, where they're brought into Thailand or Malaysia. And from the moment we landed, there were billboard after billboards of stating, if you hurt a child, you will end up in jail. I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but that was the message. But it's everywhere. We were in what I would say was one of the finer hotels in Phnom Penh, where there were foreign men in the pool with young Cambodian girls. And these men weren't their fathers.
Right.
They were speaking French or, another foreign language. So it was highly disturbing. And since then, I've read a lot on what the girls have to do to pretend that they're having a good time, and how the smile is very important. It's sickening.
So going back to the poem Bodyguard, this poem came out of your experience and seeing all of this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Go for it.
Okay. Bodyguard. When the baby came, it came in pieces. Skull dropped onto dirt where chickens scratch. Limbs fell between porcelain footsteps. I recognized my daughter's face in its face. I covered it with a rag. When the baby came, I tossed the brainstem over the wall of the tent outhouse. I drowned it in the seashore next to Khmer girls selling octopus skewers. I rubbed it against my inner thighs. I named it Helen. The bodyguard waited with a thin tissue, handed it to me. I did not know what to do with the tissue. Wipe blood off my foot. Wipe away another tear. Life begins with lovemaking and ends. I smudged her onto my husband's palm.
I don't want to give our listeners the idea that all of the poems in Thousand Cricket Song are so harsh, but this history is a really important layer of Cambodian culture, and clearly a lot still needs to be done.
That's right.
In the region.
The recovery is very slow, physically, emotionally. One of the people who I dedicate the book to is Usam Orr, who has become a very dear friend of ours. I met him about 2 years into writing this book. And since he lives in Texas, he's a survivor of the Khmer Rouge with his wife and son. And his wife, we brought them to Taos for medical care. And his wife is suffering on such a psychic level still because of having two babies pushed from her womb by Khmer Rouge nurses. I don't even want to call them nurses, midwives, and who then murdered the babies right as they were being born.
Oh my God.
And Usam Orr had to take them to the river and bury them. So the pain, her psychic pain is unbearable still.
It's so painful to just hear about
it. It is.
There's no way we can imagine.
No, we can't.
The worst.
I know. Yeah. There's a quote. I love this quote called You Who Live Safe in Your Warm Houses by a writer of the Holocaust, a survivor of the Holocaust, Primo Levi.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that quote has become part of my daily living, because here we are living in our safe, warm houses when every day,
taking it for granted.
Oh, absolutely.
And which we should be able to. Everybody should be able to, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's human right. It's a human right to live free and
exactly.
safely.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to shift a little bit. Shift to humor just for a second here. At least I felt it was kind of humorous. There's a poem that answers its own question pretty darned quickly. Flies.
Oh.
And having traveled through Kenya, I could personally relate to this poem.
This came out of, we were in Domre's village. His sister, he lives between two worlds because he lives sort of in decadence on a day-to-day basis because of his position. And when you go back to his village where he was raised, this is what you experience.
And so, reality.
Right, right. Flies. What's there not to like in a country so thick with flies? They swarm my bowl of rice. The same flies that followed me to the toilet hole in the ground where I held up my skirt, pulled down my panties and squatted, then hosed off. The same flies that landed on my naked ass as I dripped dry.
And it seems, I mean, it makes so much sense. Look at all the water we waste here. Well, your poem, is it Bhutan's Wife?
Yes.
Has some very interesting sounds and imagery. Mm-hmm. Who is Bhutan?
Bhutan is a close friend of Oak Domre's. And we went to their house for dinner where a feast was cooked. And again, the contrast between the two worlds, because in the kitchen, I have another poem in here in the book, Place Setting. And that's from that same evening in their home. And the contrast between the two worlds was the kitchen help squatting around, literally around the cooking pot in the kitchen. And all of us sitting in the dining room, and Bhutan's wife dressed so beautifully with makeup, you know, her hair in place, like she'd gone to the hairdresser, she'd gone to somebody to do her makeup, and because this was a very special dinner with Americans coming to her home. Mm-hmm. And it was, but again, it was, I was a little confused again about the contrast between how people live on a day-to-day basis and where they come from, because I have a feeling most of whom we met were not born into this dinner that we had.
Right.
And yeah. So when they go home to their village, like Oak Domre's village, there's the contrast between how they're living their daily lives and how they were brought up, which right. is, you know, true for so many of us anyway, but it's very, very evident there
right.
because of there's almost no middle class. It's extreme poverty or there's opulence.
Mm-hmm.
Bhutan's wife. She boiled the broth, boiled the birds for the pretty party, painted scarlet on her lips for an evening's permanent smirk, tore the gizzard, tore the heart that cracked the crystal with its clover cries. She held the heart in a cup as fine as the kings of the poor country, swaddled it against her breast in silk in the inexplicable pulse of wings. She climbed 100 stone temples with 100 charmed goddesses in a sun so hot, then set the sails where the rivers gather in innocence, a gesture's nakedness at her dining table under the relaxed mango tree with the delicate cow and other prized possessions. She gathered us here as unhurrying American guests, young bird remains in our bowls, eyes slightly off center.
Tell me about the nail salon.
Well, that was another. I must have gone over to the country with fingernail polish on that was chipping off. And I thought, you know, there was no fingernail polish remover. And I went into, and Siem Reap, went down a little dirt road and found a nail salon next door to where there's a, like, online computer. There was a computer, oh. And then there was the beauty, the salon. And I went in and asked to have just the nail polish remover removed from my fingernails. And in those 20 minutes of waiting and then having her remove the nail polish, there was this woman who was having her face shaved. I thought, is she going to grow back whiskers? You know, I kept thinking about that. And I kept thinking about how beauty is defined in each culture. And so to have a flawless, hairless face was very important for this woman. And many women I have since heard in Cambodia. This was one of the poems where I realized how foreign I was while there. And mm-hmm. I, yes, a woman, yes, a mother, yes, everything uh-huh. that has to do possibly what these other women experience emotionally, you know, day to day at this point, except I've not suffered genocide. Or, you know, the murder of family members. And
right.
so and the nail salon, Siem Reap. My feet have no history here. Not once have my soles been beaten, toenails pulled, yet I keep company with the girls who squat here on the warm dirt. The woman in the one salon chair goes, gradually hairless. Even fine facial hair is shaved with the unsanitary blade. I have no say in her dream. I'm without resemblance to the Khmer. My feet are American. They're so white, prettiness urine-stained by my own aimlessness. I cannot scrub hard enough. The woman admires her shaved face in the handheld mirror, beams as the toenails on her bruised feet are polished burgundy.
Why don't you go ahead and read the last poem in the book, Festival of the Reversing Current.
Festival of the Reversing Current. The moment the river reverses itself into the mouth of the Tonle Sap Lake, it is the bonzes that return for their search for their souls. Monks drifting in their persimmon robes and the blood of fertility, somewhat pale, everything in motion, bent to Buddha outside the curtained cloth. The river flows. It carries the past, present, and future. Curving through Cambodian villages, fast and familiar, its lips full with surrender, its confidence turning their heads. Heavenly apsaras and the storks lost in the foliage. The village elder sitting high in the doorway of her stilted house, receiving from the flow all that is recognizable, greater than her pallor. The old vast water, forceful and godlike in its autumnal appearance, sweeps into the waiting estuaries of their hearts, first to clean, then to harvest. Who would not walk, this dutiful gesture on naked feet, the unmistakable, dancing late into each night? Well, I think because the reason we were there was because of the reunion that my husband was having with Oak Domre. I'll read 24 years after the refugee camp, a reunion. Fireworks explode over the Mekong. The restaurant balcony is a pop-eyed gecko damp with pity. Friends drink a second anger beer each. The Khmer puts on his glasses continuously. Mind wanders between this world and the world. Tonight, the baffled city soothes itself with curious costumed dancers. The American doctor's heart grasps for forgetting in some kind of god, which is like someone wearing a mask and holding the shatters in gloved hands. I'm going to read the poem Shade. And this poem was inspired by, while I was at the Tolsling prison, from a film that I saw while there it's a documentary called The Khmer Rouge Killing Machine. And Von Nath, who is one of, I think, 8 survivors from the Tolsling prison, survived only because he was a painter and he was asked to depict what was happening in this particular prison. And he's still alive in Phnom Penh. Shade. The famous Khmer artist has placed his palm on a murderer's upper back near the neck, has pushed him toward the painting on the prison museum's wall. Outside the perimeter, the mother is mute on her knees. Her hands cradle a beautiful fatigue as if she had just remembered why. A bayonet blade held upright to catch an infant as it spins through the air. The shade shades the body this evening in Phnom Penh. He cleans his brushes alone each day in the medicinal turpentine, wipes his palate clean, and becomes silent. The painting is his settlement with humiliation. You can hear the crickets trill in the banyans. You can hear the whole evening is crying louder. Because my own personal antenna is now with all the slavery that's going on with young girls in Cambodia and other countries, I think I will end with this poem, Fortune, which touches on why girls are sold by their mothers and fathers' fortune. Born pretty in Cambodia, she suffers her father and older brothers as they drug, then carry her, often without underwear, to the roadside in late afternoon. She is the virgin living the legend as the cure for AIDS and hunger. For 1 week, I see her young hands reach for the Khmer, who leaves her to be paid for by foreign men. 2 years later, I think of her handheld mirror, its crack of recognition between our cultures. Pretty.
This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. You were just listening to an interview with Catherine Strisik, author of Thousand Cricket Song. Up next is Molly Fisk, but before we go to her, here is Anne Waldman performing her poem along with Ambrose Bye, The Marriage of William Blake.
The Marriage of William Blake. On the day of his death, he stopped work and turned to Catherine, who was in tears. "Stay, Kate, keep just as you are. I will draw your portrait, for you have ever been an angel to me." As he finished, he put it down and began to sing verses and hymns. "My beloved, they are not mine." William Blake was singing out of gladness. Right before their 45th anniversary, he told his wife they would never be parted, that he would be close with her always. At 6 in the evening, he breathed his last like the sighing of a gentle breeze. His eye brightened, and he burst out into singing the things he saw in heaven. She then saw him continually, where he used to come and sit with her for 2 or 3 hours every day. He took his chair and talked to her, just as he would have done had he been alive. William, sweet William. On the day of her death, she was as calm and as cheerful as her husband had been, repeating texts of scripture and calling continually to her William, as if he were only in the next room, to say she was coming to him and would not be long now.
This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. My next guest is Molly Fisk. It has been a few years since she's been on Word Temple, and I'm glad to have her back. She has a new book out called The More Difficult Beauty, published by Hip Pocket Press in Orinda, California. Molly Fisk teaches poetry privately and runs the popular online workshop Poetry Bootcamp. You can find information about that at poetrybootcamp.com. She teaches cancer patients and caregivers to boost their immune systems through writing and speaks on the subjects of creativity, power, and child abuse. Her fellowship and grant awards in poetry include the National Endowment for the Arts, the California Arts Council, and the Marin County, California Arts Council. And her poetry has been awarded the Dogwood Prize, Robinson Jeffers Torhouse Prize, Billy Murray Denny Prize, and the National Writers Union Prize. She lives in the Sierra foothills of California. Her books of poems, previous to The More Difficult Beauty, include Listening to Winter, Terrain, which she wrote along with Forrest Hamer and Don Bellum, and Saltwater Poems. Here now is Molly Fisk.
I tell my students that it's hard to write political poetry. It's hard not to be preaching. And one of the ways to focus on a poem, if you're trying to say something, which I was here, is really just to talk about where you are with it. Make it as personal as possible. This is called American Riddle. When you can't figure out how to stop the war in Iraq, much less how to make enough money to pay your mortgage, moving the $180 from savings back into your checking account, as if that will help. When it's all you can do to acknowledge the actual world and not lose yourself half the afternoon in People magazine, where the movie stars twirl like frosted cakes in a glass case at the Old Lady Baltimore Bakery on Throckmorton, before your hometown became so chic none of the kids from your high school could afford to live there. When you're so tired of reinventing yourself, you want to lie down on the road, right on the double yellow line in front of your driveway, exactly where two of your cats have been killed, and wait for someone to run you over. But with your luck, you'd probably just lose an arm, no doubt the right one, so you'd have to relearn holding the pencil against the page at the proper angle, and your sweater's sleeves would need to be hemmed to cover the stump. And then you'd really have something to complain about, as well as something in common with soldiers back from the Middle East, who left a precious part of themselves behind, which is where this poem begins and ends. How the hell are we going to stop the cavalier waste? How are we going to apologize? Much of this book is written for and about my mother, who died in 2000 of ovarian cancer. This is called The Way a Daughter Would Know Her. Less nurse than wry smile across an easel, and if you're so hungry, you make dinner. Early morning emptier of dish drainers. Less hiker than salt swimmer, head resolutely above water. About equal mother and daughter, rarely disobedient as either. Younger sister, wicked tennis partner. Driver of station wagons, stitcher of tiny smocked dresses, knitter of reindeer sweaters, finder of mittens, repairer of wrenched zippers. Less gullible than you would at first glance guess. Reader, when stressed, of Marjorie Ellingham, Robert Frost, The New Yorker. Adlai Stevenson admirer. Staunch arguer for human rights, but not a public speaker. Nettler of windbags. Planned Parenthood donor. Less gin and tonic than Earl Grey. More Yardley's English lavender than oil of Olay. Follower of recipes exactly. Flour sifter. Minister's child. Eventual attendant at church, but I only go to sing in the choir. More laugher than joke teller. Practiced eye-roller. Quick observer of human emotion, noter of an infinite variety of color. Unshakable Vermont lover, but hold the maple sugar. Happy wife, and then less so of a philanderer as long as she could stand it, and lonely after. At the piano with the same Bach over and over. More listener than talker, but in time ears failed her. Learner of American sign. Ovarian cancer non-survivor. More alive in mind than a handful of chalk under marble next to her parents in Saxonville. It's hard not to love the poems that have made you money. I try not to play favorites, and I'm pretty good about it. But, you know, it's really so unusual as a poet to make any money. That when you send a poem into a contest and somebody likes it and you get a check back in the mail, it's just such a thrill. It's very hard to not love the poem a little bit more because it has given you this windfall. And this is one of my prize-winning poems, sort of like going to the county fair. It's called Washington Square, New York, 1941. When Edward Hopper finishes his painting for the night, sets the boar bristles to soak in turpentine, wipes the thick, not yet crusted over drips from his smock with a blue rag, and tips his palette up to incubate tomorrow's luck. He isn't thinking of the greenish light from a street lamp, how it hits plate glass and fractures through it, or the counter's corner in an all-night city diner. Most of the time he is just hungry, already smelling the stew his wife likes to make from white beans and bacon. his eyes lose focus, and his other senses, so long ignored in deference to saturated color, come alive, more vivid now because of their confinement. How clear the little click as the lamp's wick sinks below its silver mouth, scritch of boot heels on the tile stair when he descends. He inhales the evening, the butcher's bloody work, stale malt that drifts from a window. The snowy world receives him, flakes melt and run down his cheeks. This is called Daybreak. Dark still and cold, the cats have me pinned under too few covers. What was I dreaming? Something with uneasiness I can still taste. A hawk in one of my pines is piercing the wind over and over with his call, except there is no wind. Too bad for the poem, but once you start lying for beauty, it's over. Dale says those are young red tails who call like that unending. I've decided to believe him. He's the sort who squats to smell unfamiliar scat and poke it with a stick to see what the pooper was eating. I know this is a hawk, but how do I know it? Years trailing my grandmother as she explained, then short bursts of observation. Even when I learned that red tails claim the tops of telephone poles, while the red-shouldered Butio lineatus prefer the swinging wire, I still couldn't tell them apart, and I may have reversed the preferences. At what point in a life does it matter that you can tell one hawk from another? When Joanna sat by a picture window overlooking Lake Michigan with her demented mother and wanted to point out a seagull, its name eluded her menopausal brain. But her mother said, with kindness, perhaps recognizing that stunned look, or slipping back to a time when Joanna pointed at everything, "Let's call it a bird." Maybe we don't take any distinctions into the grave. I've lost the streets in Cambridge, even though for years I walked and drove them, rolled them on my tongue. And what are years? I think of an oval, a quarter-mile high school track, with winter and summer the longer sides. Here it is September, early for this kind of cold, and we're about to swoop through fall, passing those ever-trumpeted social holidays, until it's as dark as it gets, the gods arraying themselves on the bleachers in peacoats and plaid mufflers like college kids in the 50s, cheering as we take the bend, panting under the weight of our little incandescent lives, naming the birds and flowers, naming our children or cats or cars, mountain peaks and heretofore undiscovered star clusters, establishing facts to surround us as protection against the void, trying to avoid all intimation of the void. Words are still a comfort, even as age removes them from our grasp. Daybreak, for instance. How did breaking enter someone's mind when light crested the highest hill, flooding the world with yellow? I like to think it was a woman at her baking, one who glanced up as that gold lit the dust of flour, the china bowl, who watched the sun's yolk spreading out across the hill, unbroken, daylight pouring now into the jagged shell, halved in her open palm. This book is in sections. It's probably got the fifth title I ever gave it, and it's probably got the 12th ordering. And the sections are things like blood, water, sugar, fire, color. And these next two poems come from the sugar section. Candy bar tutorial. What he leaves on the bed or slips into her pocket after the car wash during the Saturday hike. Baby Ruth, mounds, big hunk, Milky Way, bit of honey. What he whispers, you made me do it. Don't pretend you don't like it. If you tell, I'll hurt your mother. What he leaves on the bed or slips into her pocket, she eats right then or sneaks into a shoebox at the top of the closet. Her mother won't like it. Mounds, Big Hunk, Milky Way, Baby Ruth, Bit of Honey. When the man in the next town murders his wife with a nail gun, she thinks of ten pennies scattered among what he leaves on the bed or slips into her pocket. Setting the table for dinner, knife blades face inward. The aluminum taste in her mouth is almost erased by Milky Way, Baby Ruth, Big Hunk, Mounds, Bit of Honey. But not completely. Still the hint of brine to remind her of home and family, sickening harmony. What he left on the bed and slipped into her pocket. Big Hunk, Milky Way, Baby Ruth, Mounds, Bit of Honey. And now we'll move from the gas station candy rack into my backyard. This is called Windfall. Deer have eaten the pear's branches at the tips, leaf and stem, devoured the windfalls, and taken delicate bites from what they could reach above their heads. The indentations more rabbit than whitetail. The wounds bound over a little, no longer bleeding juice. As I twist the fruit from its birthplace, what once was a blossom sunny interior, I start to sing a Scottish air my mother taught us in childhood. A man overhearing a woman singing a prayer to her lover, gone to sea, that his keel may row well, that his blue bonnet stay on his head. I love its layered nature, someone telling someone else's story, even though it becomes his own in the telling, how we absorb the world around us and pass it on. And the woman singing her worry into something almost holy, something a stranger walking through the gate into town will remember. Since I was young, listening to my mother's alto harmonize with the slosh of soapy water in the kitchen sink, I've hoped the sailor came back to her. I've hoped it hard. And even though with age I know more about the futility of hope and the unlikeliness of happy endings, whenever I sing the song, it feels like there might be a chance he did. Each pear is paired, I see. They grow on doubled stems. When one is plucked, the other follows. Rather than stay aloft alone, it tumbles down. The multitude of pears is my own windfall, tree that I pruned in March and then ignored, giving and giving its sweetness into my hands, the baskets filling and overflowing, the flesh crisp, white, the skin some unnameable color of green. Green when everything else is turning gold and crimson. Last true green of a difficult summer. Green for the reunion of every sailor with every bonny lass. Green of the unpredictably generous world. There are some love poems in this book, and this is called First Winter. A cold night, the power out, and February, where they are slowly chipping calico layers of wallpaper off a kitchen ceiling, balanced on wooden ladders they dragged from under a tarp in the barn. Votives on the counter, and in the next room their first necessary fire. She has taught him to make quesadillas, leave room for the milk in her tea. He's taught her he won't leave. Together, they have painted the living room black-eyed Susan yellow, planted lilacs. They don't know how hard it will be. The first layer of papers, crisp black and red, is as painful in the old house as the place where the scraper slices his palm. Blood wells to match the ceiling. A few bright drops splash, almost lost on the spattered linoleum floor. She hunts up a Band-Aid, abandoned in the medicine chest, and wipes the cut clean with an old towel. They have made their vows. Candlelight spins the shadows of their hands across rain-slick window glass. They scrape until their shoulders ache, through decades of paper, past all their college blue books, diaphragms and operettas, past the damp palms of high school dances, the caught frogs and molding petri dishes of third grade, to the smiles of their exhausted mothers on the different days they were born, each successive layer softer toned and sweeter than the last, until they reach gold roses on pale green stems and stop to admire them. Some of the poems in this book are about my own history, and some are, as I've said, about my mother, and some of those intersect. And I want to read you two. This is called Deconstruction. In the end, we never had the conversation. Where were you when he, and how could you not have noticed? She never said, I'm so sorry you were harmed. I'd give my left arm to have saved you. Instead, well, you know how he was. No one could stop him. This must be how I learned, at 10 or 12, to carry my life in my own hands, to walk steadily toward anyone's rage, not flinching. As she lies on the hospital bed, I can see myself in her drawn face, the cheekbones, angle of nostrils, and he inhabits my wrists and eyes and shoulders. But I am not really their daughter after all. I am the child of narcissism and panic, of cause and its friend effect, and any resemblance to them is purely coincidence. In this poem, the names have been changed. The people's names have been changed, but the ice cream names have not been changed. Called Belonging. Long after I'd remember most of it, after my mother had said, you've wrecked my life, and Ellen asked me not to send her the poems because they ruined her sex life, and Tom wondered aloud if I was recalling a past life, after Nan said over the phone, by the way, I don't believe you, and Henry told some of my friends at dinner that I'd always been a liar, after I'd gained 100 pounds and begun to carry it like an open window, and after enough time had passed to dull my anger down to a simmer, I walked to the kitchen one day, a sunny day, a Tuesday, heading for Häagen-Dazs or Ben and Jerry's, and caught my face in the mirror unawares, the rosy cheeks, slight clench in the jaw, and looked back at myself directly with my father's eyes, the purpose in them clear, all the power he carried toward my bed that I was bearing in the direction of ice cream. And I understood how humans do what they do, how they can't not do it. And at that moment, I loved my father, so dangerous and helpless, and loved myself for loving him again.
That was Molly Fisk reading from her latest collection of poems, The More Difficult Beauty, published by Hip Pocket Press. And of course, this gives me another opportunity to remind you that I will be reading from my new book of poems, Updraft, published by Finishing Line Press, along with Molly Fisk, on Thursday, September 23rd at 7 p.m. at Books, Inc., 2251 Chestnut Street in San Francisco. If you have any questions about that reading, you can give me a holler at khastings@wordtemple.com. And here's another reminder. On Saturday, October 23rd at 7 p.m. at the Sebastopol Center for the Arts, you are invited to attend a party celebrating the end of 5 years of the Word Temple Poetry Series. Joining us that night will be the award-winning Chicano poet and educator Francisco X. Alarcón, Judy Gron, along with singer-songwriter Ann Carol Mitchell, Jack and Adele Foley, and more. For more information, again, you can contact me at khastings@wordtemple.com. We have a few minutes left tonight, and I'm just in the mood for a little Lawrence Ferlinghetti. So here he is.
Autobiography. I am leading a quiet life in Mike's place every day, watching the champs of the Dante Billiard Parlor and the French pinball addicts. I'm leading a quiet life on Lower East Broadway. I am an American. I was an American boy. I read the American Boy magazine and became a Boy Scout in the suburbs. I thought I was Tom Sawyer, catching crayfish in the Bronx River and imagining the Mississippi. I had a baseball mitt and an American Flyer bike. I delivered the Woman's Home Companion at 5 in the afternoon, or the Herald Trib at 5 in the morning. I still can hear the paper thump on lost porches. I had an unhappy childhood. I saw Lindbergh land. I looked homeward and saw no angel. I got caught stealing pencils from the 5- and 10-cent store the same month I made Eagle Scout. I chopped trees for the CCC and sat on them. I landed in Normandy in a rowboat that turned over. I have seen the educated armies on the beach at Dover. I have seen Egyptian pilots in purple clouds, shopkeepers rolling up their blinds at midday, potato salad and dandelions at anarchist picnics. I am reading a life of John Most, terror of the industrialist, a bomb on his desk at all times. I have seen the garbage men parade in the Columbus Day parade behind the glib farting trumpeters. I have not been out to the cloisters in a long time, nor to the Tuileries, but I still keep thinking of going. I have seen the garbage men parade when it was snowing. I have eaten hot dogs in ballparks. I have heard the Gettysburg Address and the Ginsburg Address. I like it here, and I won't go back where I came from. I, too, have ridden boxcars, boxcars, boxcars. I have traveled among unknown men. I have been in Asia with Noah in the Ark. I was in India when Rome was built. I have been in the manger with an ass. I have seen the Eternal Distributor from a white heel in South San Francisco and the Laughing Woman at Luna Park outside the Funhouse in a great rainstorm still laughing. I have heard the sound of revelry by night. I have wandered lonely as a crowd. I am leading a quiet life outside of Mike's Place every day, watching the world walk by in its curious shoes. I once started out to walk around the world, but ended up in Brooklyn. That bridge was too much for me. I have engaged in silence, exile, and cunning. I flew too near the sun, and my wax wings fell off. I am looking for my old man, whom I never knew. I am looking for the lost leader with whom I flew. Young men should be explorers. Home is where one starts from. But Mother never told me there'd be scenes like this. Womb-weary, I rest. I have traveled. I have seen Goof City. I have seen the mass mess. I have heard Kid Ory cry. I have heard a trombone preach. I have heard Debussy strain through a sheet. I have slept in 100 islands where books were trees. I have heard the birds that sound like bells. I have worn gray flannel trousers and walked upon the beach of hell. I have dwelt in 100 cities where trees were books. What subways, what taxis, what cafes, what women with blind breasts, limbs lost among skyscrapers. I have seen the statues of heroes at carrefours, Danton weeping at a metro entrance, Columbus in Barcelona pointing westward up the Ramblas toward the American Express. Lincoln in his stony chair and a great stone face in North Dakota. I know that Columbus did not invent America. I have heard 100 outspoken Ezra Pounds. They should all be freed. It is long since I was a herdsman. I am leading a quiet life in Mike's Place every day.
This is Catherine Hastings, and that was Lawrence Ferlinghetti Getty performing his poem Autobiography. My guests tonight were poets Catherine Strisik, author of Thousand Cricket Songs, and Molly Fisk, author of The More Difficult Beauty. If you have any comments or questions about tonight's show, please send them to me at khastings@wordtemple.com. Thanks for listening.